We are so lucky to have such a diversity of wildlife in our state. There's something to watch for and kind of marvel at in every season of the year, isn't there? And fall, certainly no exception. Larry Mueller here. David Drake is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. David, always great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for continuing to invite me back.
And Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, our guest as well. And Jamie, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Larry. It's great to be back on the show.
It's great to have you back. And as you listen in to Jamie and to David, I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. What kinds of wildlife have you been noticing lately? What are they up to? Love to hear from you. Maybe you've got a question about what's going on out there. Certainly love to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. We certainly would love to hear from you. And maybe we just start out with a comment on the wolf situation, the wolf hunt situation. David, want to bring us?
Well, there's always a lot of wonderful things going on in the wildlife world, but part of that is also the humans that live in that world with them. And right now, between the Deer Trustee report and the trying to promulgate new wolf rules, there's a lot of opportunity for humans to interject their opinion. And wildlife is equated to a lot. I always say you should never talk about religion and politics because everybody's got an opinion on that, and wildlife is no exception to that rule. So there's a lot going on, and there's a wolf harvest going on right now. Jamie's got some numbers updated, but it's been interesting to watch the rapidity with how fast those wolves are getting harvested right now.
Yeah,
I can give you some current stats. I guess as of about an hour and a half ago, the Department of Natural Resources just updated their website. So those of you that want to kind of follow the harvest, there's an excellent website that's being updated regularly. The wolf harvest is divided among six zones throughout the state. The season started October 15th this year, and to date, 110 wolves have been harvested in just 8 days of the season. By comparison, 42 wolves were taken last year within the first 16 days of the season. So we're, harvesting wolves at a much, much faster rate this year compared to last year. And just a few other interesting things. More than half of the wolves harvested so far have been trapped. Mm-hmm. Others have been hunted, both with gun and at least one bow kill. The harvest has been represented over two dozen counties throughout the state, and as far south as Columbia County, where at least two wolves have been harvested to date.
Mm. So that's continuing on. And you mentioned deer as well, David. The Deer Trustee report is moving forward, and we're in a time period of public input on that right now. Maybe you can remind us what that report covers and how it was put together.
Yeah, so the Deer Trustee report was something that was generated through Governor Walker's administration, and they hired Dr. James Kroll, who's a deer biologist from Texas, and then he brought on two colleagues of his, Dr. David Gwynn and Dr. Gary Ault, and they were charged with examining the way that the DNR manages the deer population in the state, and there was nothing off limits to them, so they were expected to look at everything, the sex age kill model and how deer are harvested, harvest zones, harvest dates, deer management units, size of, and things like that. And so they issued a pretty lengthy report and it was called the Deer Trustee Report. And that has come out in final form now. And so now they are, as of October 15th, through the end of this month, the DNR is holding 35 public hearings throughout the state. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go to the DNR website, you can find both the location and date and time for hearings that you might want to attend as a member of the public. And you're welcome to give any input you want on that Deer Trustee report. And then yesterday, the Natural Resource Board heard from a variety of scientists, both DNR and University of Wisconsin, and I believe tribal scientists as well, about the various factions of the Deer Trustee report and what should be kept and maybe should be reexamined with a closer eye. And so it is a very interesting time right now in managing wildlife.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some areas probably drawing more public attention than others from that report.
Yeah, I think it depends on what stakeholder group you belong to, but certainly the hunters are a big stakeholder group that the DNR certainly listens to. And so one of the things in the Deer Trustee report is that they were suggesting some different season, limits and lengths and mm-hmm. things like that. And so one of the things that they would do away with, or the recommendation is to do away with the antlerless harvest during December. And so that's an example of how they would modify some of the seasons. But, people are interested in also this Deer Management Assistance Program was a big tenet of the Deer Trustee report. And so essentially it's trying to make deer management more localized and not so much from a larger deer management unit perspective.
So talking with David Drake and Jamie Knack today as we take a look at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin, certainly inviting you to join in with your questions and comments. There are questions relating to hibernation. I think there's migration questions that we I know people have. What about you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Isaac in Green Bay, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. I had a question. Thanks for letting me in the air. Is the increased number of wolves being hunted and trapped due to more hunters or more wolves in the population?
Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for the question. And I think that's a really common question out there right now as we're watching this hunt progress. And it's maybe a little early to have a definitive answer to that, but you can certainly speculate that there were more permits issued this year. So last year's harvest goal for state wolves was 116 wolves. Of that, 117 were harvested. And then this year, the quota was 251. And I know at least last year, it was 10 times the number of animals they would like to see harvested. 10 times that number is how many permits were issued. And at this point, I think there was around 1,800 or so folks that purchased the license when they received that successful draw. And there were still another 800 or 900 that could purchase a license. In other words, they were successful in the drawing to be able to harvest a wolf. So bottom line, there are more wolves to be taken this year, and there are more hunters and trappers on the landscape as we speak than there were previously. And I don't know what kind of effect the cooler temperatures have had, how that compares to last year's weather. So there's a lot of different potential players. And this is really new. This is only the second season that we've had, and these trends, it'll take a few years to watch if this was an anomaly or if this is how things will track in the future as well.
Thanks, Isaac. Let's go to Linda in Iron Belt, Wisconsin. Linda, hi.
Hi. I have two questions. First one is, when is bear hunting season? And we have snow up here already. Are they asleep already?
Oh, the bears? You're Iron Belt. I'm trying to recall where it's exactly where you're located.
7 miles south of Hurley.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so the bear season, I believe the bear season's closed now, or if it hasn't closed already, it will be closing soon. And obviously, because the bears are starting to go into hibernation now, and typically mid-October is when they start looking for hibernation spots, and we'll start laying up for the winter. And certainly, by mid-November or so, beginning to hibernate.
We got snow up here already. We got 4 or 5 inches already.
It's not so much the snow or the weather as much as the primary cue that gets animals hibernating or gets animals migrating or breeding or whatever that part of their life cycle is. But the primary cue is length of daylight, and so that's what's really driving this.
Okay.
And so you could get snow, but if the length of daylight is still rather long and the bears are active, they're not quite ready to go. And their system's not telling them it's time to go take a sleep.
I just thought of another question. Do eagles migrate or do we get them year-round?
It depends on ice cover. So obviously eagles will eat a variety of food resources. They'll certainly eat land mammals and things like that, but they fish a lot. And so if there's open leads in the water, they will stick around for that. And as a matter of fact, I think it's the second weekend in January, Sauk City up just north of Dane County there, that they have eagle days. And so one of the reasons they have eagle days up there is the Wisconsin River has leads open where they'll have ice on the river, but there's enough open water that the eagles can stick around and find fishing spots.
Guile flowage up here, and we've seen a lot of eagles up here this year.
So. Yep. As long as they've got a food resource that they can take advantage of throughout the winter, they'll stick around.
Good. Okay. All right. Well, hey, thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Ann in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I got a question. My Webster's Dictionary defines harvest as, at least the verbal form, as to gather in a crop that is of grain, fruit, vegetables, etc. And for about the last 15 years anyway, I know that the people who are hunters or represent hunters and DNR and similar groups have referred to the killing of animals as harvesting animals as if they were vegetables and didn't have any pain receptors. I was wondering when this the use of harvest for live animals began and why.
All right.
Well, thanks, Ann. I will take a stab at trying to explain that. And I think it is in the best of interest that we're trying to use the word harvest rather than killing. First of all, I think it is more just politically correct and more sensitive in terms of using the word harvest and to collect. And when you talk about like an agricultural product, the goal of wildlife management at times is also to create that surplus. Leopold talked about this decades ago about wildlife management being creating a surplus to be able to be harvested and likened wildlife management to agricultural use of resources. So
goes back to Leopold.
Well, I don't know if that's the origination of it, but it is
at
certainly
least that far.
It is a term that I consciously use the word harvest as much as possible over killing, but the same endpoint is there.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for calling, Marty in Douglas County. Your turn. Hi, Marty.
And I'd also like to talk about the wolf hunt. I was floored when I heard the numbers that are projected to be killed this year. And they are killed. To say harvest replaces the word kill is kind of, I don't know, isn't very appropriate. Anyway, 200-some are to be killed this year as opposed to less than half that last year. I haven't heard a number on the numbers of wolves we think are in the state.
How many wolves are in the state?
So
what's the projected? What's the end point here? At what point will there no longer be wolf hunting in Wisconsin? What are you shooting for? What are we trying to get back down to for numbers?
Yeah, that's a good question.
All right, so this is a collective decision amongst many stakeholders. But the wolf management plan, the recovery plan, the goal is still at 350, and that is part of the process that David alluded to earlier on. That there are decisions being made and discussed right now in terms of the future of wolf management in the state and what those goals should be. That's all, you know, a state of ongoing consideration and relooking at things. Right now it's 350. That is certainly not the goal with one season's worth of harvest. The minimum track count in the winter, I want to say it was in the 800s, but that's prior to reproduction this spring and this summer. So we're at the high point right now during the hunting season, is at the high point of the wolf population, and DNR often will refer to that being a doubling effect mm-hmm. with reproduction. So the goal with this season and why it was upped, or you know, part of the reason it was up from 116 last year to 251 this year is that last year there really was very little movement in the population. It was either remained stable or a slight decrease. So the goal this year is somewhere between like a 10 and 14% reduction in the population. They're approaching this very cautiously because it hasn't occurred in the state before.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
I would just add too, Marty. So, The wolf rules are going under consideration now, and so there are opportunities for you as a public citizen to have your input heard. But I will stress and emphasize that the harvest is being done scientifically. There's nothing here that's being done in a wanton, willy-nilly type fashion. It is tightly regulated. It's very closely monitored, and it's all scientifically driven. And I understand people may not agree with harvesting, killing, shooting wolves, trapping, however you want to call it, But the best science to date is going into managing the wolf population.
Okay. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. We've got a quiz that we're going to, a wildlife quiz that we're going to be giving you in just a minute. Right after, I remind you that Judith Sears Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with David and Jamie, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension, our guests. And they like to throw a quiz question out to all of you. So we've got another one today. We're going to pick a winner at random from all the correct answers. And that person is going to get a one-year family membership to the International Crane Foundation. So thanks to our friends at the International Crane Foundation for that prize. A very nice prize, a really family membership. You can email your answer to talk@wpr.org. So that's talk@wpr.org. Please put quiz in the subject line and also include your first and last name and where you live in the message. So put quiz in the subject line and then include your first and last name and where you live in the message. You can also call at 1-800-642-1234 with your answer, but you might run into busy phone lines. So that could be an issue. It's 1-800-642-1234. Here is the question. David Drake saw four whooping cranes flying behind an ultralight plane on Tuesday, October 22nd of this year. What is the name of the project that helps those hoopers get to their wintering ground safely? So what's the name of what do they call this whole project with the ultralight plane leading the hoopers? Give you 10 minutes to get your answer in. You can call or email with your answer. Again, you email us at talk@wpr.org, put quiz in the subject line, first and last name, and then the name of the project that helps those hoopers get to their wintering grounds safely. 10 minutes. And, you know, there's, we've got those hoopers going, but there's a lot more of our wildlife, our bird wildlife on their way south, too.
Yep, Most of the young, the small birds, like the warblers and things, have moved out of here already. There are some late migrants, but certainly sandhill cranes are one of the later migrants. The waterfowl are, things like that. Most of the bats, have moved out of our area and are starting to look for places to hibernate if they're the state resident bats. So it's an active time, for sure.
Very active time. And I know there's been some questions about the status of our bat population with all the concern about white nose syndrome. Where are we with that now?
Well, the DNR is continuing to closely monitor white nose syndrome. They're going into caves in the wintertime and looking for bats that may have white nose syndrome and taking samples of the fungal community in there and things like that. And so far, knock on wood, they have not found white nose syndrome in Wisconsin. And it's kind of an interesting thing that they have not, because we are more or less surrounded by it. It's up in Ontario. It's surrounding us to the east. There was a report that it was possibly found down in Iowa, although that is possibly the way they found it was not with the common test for white nose syndrome. So that report is in question. But I believe it's into Ohio and Kentucky and Missouri and areas like that. So we literally are surrounded by it. And why it's not in Wisconsin is a bit of a question mark still.
Probably blind luck.
Hopefully. And hopefully it continues that way.
Yeah, we sure do hope that. You can join in, by the way, with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. We'd certainly love to hear from you. A couple of DNR employees have been recognized for their service recently. Wildlife biologist Adrian Whiteven got a nice award, David.
Yep, he sure did. Our professional society is called the Wildlife Society, and we just hosted the Wisconsin chapter of the Wildlife Society, just hosted the national annual meeting earlier this month in Milwaukee, and Adrian was honored with the Jim McDonough Award, and that award is to somebody who is a certified wildlife biologist in the Wildlife Society and has made significant contributions to wildlife management, and certainly Adrian qualifies for that, he is currently now a forest wildlife health specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, but for many, many years before that, he actually was the wolf biologist, and he did he really oversaw the wolf program and saw it from the time that wolves began to recolonize Wisconsin and kind of rode that roller coaster as they were taken off the endangered species list and put it back on the list and taken off and put it back on. And so if anybody deserves that award, certainly Adrian does. And our hat is off to Adrian, and we certainly applaud him for that.
And Conservation Warden Juan Gomez of Walworth County is this year's National Boating Officer of the Year, which is pretty cool. Top honor.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, and it's the third time a Wisconsin DNR conservation warden has netted that top honor from the National Association.
Pretty nice award.
Yep, congratulations. Everybody should feel comfortable and confident that the wildlife resource is being stewarded very well by the state agency.
Karen in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. I have a quick question. I just want to know, where do, like, the nuthatches and chickadees winter? Is it in the trees, the nests, or whatever? And should I leave my birdhouses out? I know it sounds like a silly question, but I guess I never really thought about it.
No, good question.
Hi, Karen. There are no silly questions. That's what I was told in second grade, at least. And so that's a good question. You can leave your birdhouses out, although the birds will not use them. But what might use them instead are deer mice. And so you want to be careful a little bit about if you leave your birdhouse out, especially with bluebird boxes, typically it's recommended that you leave them open forcibly leave them open so they can't accidentally shut, because otherwise deer mice will occupy in there. And it's not the worst thing in the world if deer mice do occupy your birdhouse. It's just something you'll have to clean out in the spring. But nuthatches and chickadees, juncos, as a matter of fact, I just saw juncos back in our area on my bike ride home the other day. All those birds are state resident species. They'll winter over here in Wisconsin, and they will hang out in evergreen trees, and they'll hang out in your backyard. And they're actually a very, very common bird at a lot of your feeders if you put feeders out.
Very cool.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Karen. Stephen Eau Claire. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I appreciate that and your program. So I just had a question about timber wolves. I had a friend of mine that was in northern Minnesota. They were doing some sprucing up in the forest land up there. And he looked up, heard some noise, looked up, and there was a timber wolf charging. And as he looked up, of course, he didn't really have time to react or anything, but it charged at him. And about 3 feet from him, it turned aside and went right around him, just like a bat would go around a head or something, and kept on going. And just wondered, what was going on. And
Oh, man. Well, that would give you a little bit of a start.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Steve, for sharing that. I can remember reading numerous reports throughout the state of Wisconsin, too, of loggers, folks who were in doing timber harvesting, that had wolves, come in as they were cutting timber in the area and kind of be on the periphery of that and observing them and some of them being rather bold. And, it's hard to say what the wolf is thinking at that point. But curiosity is one aspect of it. Also, if that person was in the wolf's territory, it's, possibly challenging the person who's in the territory. So it's difficult to say for certain, but those are two possible explanations, just curiosity or challenging the territory.
Cool.
Someone said that timber wolves won't actually attack a human being. Is that true or no?
There are reports.
There are a few reports, but it's it's one of those things you can never say never. But it is a rare situation. I believe there was one recently, and it was the wolf had a deformity. It looked like it had an injury in its jaw, but it had came from behind and attacked a young man that was sitting near some water, and it was just a freak incident.
Yeah.
So certainly not common. Not considered a prey. Humans are not considered a prey item.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Tom in Lake Mills wonders how the Wisconsin elk herd is doing. David, do you want to take that?
Sure, I will. It is doing actually quite well. So they obviously have the initial population that was reestablished up at Clam Lake, and that population seems to be growing. And as a matter of fact, I think they had a pretty good calving season this past year. And obviously now they're trying to reestablish, or they're possibly thinking about reestablishing another population of elk down in the Black River Falls Central Forest area. And so that would be a great thing if they could do that.
Yeah, so things are going pretty well.
Yeah, they are. Yep. Absolutely.
Faith in Hudson, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Question about birds. I'm changing the subject a little bit, not about wolves, but we see bluebirds a lot, and some people see them in the winter. Do they migrate, or what happens with them?
Faith, that's a good question. So bluebirds are insectivores, and they eat insects, obviously, and any bird that's an insect-eating bird has to leave our area if it gets cold enough here, and the insects go away. And so sometimes, on rare occasions, bluebirds will be here throughout the winter if we have a kind of a mild winter and there's enough insects for them to survive on, but most of the time they leave our state and go south, and they'll go as far south as they need to where the insects are still active year-round.
Mm-hmm. So then if there are some here in the winter, what are they doing? Are they living?
They are eking out a living. And if it gets, obviously, you know, one of the ways that birds survive through the winter is they eat enough to keep enough energy that they can stay warm. And if we get into a situation with that bluebird or those bluebirds where they cannot find enough food to generate enough energy to stay warm, they'll unfortunately perish here in the winter.
Faith, thanks again for calling. I appreciate your call. We had an email from Gail, who was biking on the Southeast Trail in Madison, saw a note right at a tunnel saying, don't go in with clothing or shoes that have been in another cave. She said, those signs need to be in the parking lots, not right next to the cave, which makes sense to me.
It does make some sense, or at least to duplicate the signage effort in case not everybody accesses from the parking lot. But, that hits on the white nose syndrome. That's why that signage is there, and I'm not familiar with that particular situation, but that would be the fungal disease that they're trying to prevent the spread.
The contest is over, and if you're just tuning in, we had a great question from David and Jamie, and a lot of people. I probably had quite a few people that had answers, the correct answer here, but the question was: David saw four whooping cranes flying behind an ultralight airplane. What's the name of the project that helps those hoopers get to their wintering grounds safely? And we gave people 10 minutes to get an answer in. And so what's the correct answer?
Well, the correct answer is Operation Migration.
And, Operation Migration.
And Jim, congratulations on getting that. You know, especially I guess it's a little apropos today. We talk a lot about some of the controversial wildlife issues that are going on. And certainly wolves and deer are always seem to be controversial, and it's hard to gain a consensus on that. But we do sometimes overlook all the positive stories about wildlife management, and certainly the recovery of the whooping cranes, which is an endangered species of bird. It's the tallest bird in North America. That is one of the positive wildlife stories certainly in the last half century or so. You know, the whooping cranes it was thought that there were only 15 left in the world at one point, and now they're back to the point where they're not quite on their own. They're not off the endangered species list, but they've made a pretty nice comeback and recovery. And so here in Wisconsin, in the Sita, up in the Sandhill area, that they have what's called an experimental population of whooping cranes, and so they've had a pretty good crop of whooping cranes. They've had off and on years. Some of the black flies sometimes will defeat the nesting season, but this year they've had nine whooping cranes that they're trying to lead south, and they go to Florida down there in winter in Florida. And one of the things they do, where the Operation Migration comes in, is they train these whooping cranes to follow an ultralight airplane, which is essentially a motorized hang glider. And I've always heard about this, and I've seen some video of it. And obviously, there was a movie entitled Fly Away With Me or something like that that kind of documents some of this. But yesterday, I live in West Middleton in Dane County, and yesterday I'm driving down Old Sauk Road, for those of you who may know where that is, and I look to my left, I look to the north, and I see this ultralight plane coming over the treetops, and I think not too much of it because we're not too far from the Middleton Airport, and I'm thinking, that's kind of neat. A little cold to be up there today, this morning. And sure enough, I look behind them, and there's four birds, and I stop and get out of my truck and get the binoculars. I've got my daughter with me, and we look at these birds, and sure enough, there's four whooping cranes flying behind this ultralight plane, and it was a stunningly fascinating thing to see. And we just stood there, mouth agape, watching this. And as a matter of fact, if you know where Pope Farm Park is, it's a Middleton Park there, that the ultralight plane circled a alfalfa field a couple of times and eventually landed in Pope Farm Park, and the birds came right down behind the ultralight, and they rested the birds in Pope Farm Park and then took off again.
Off again.
But they kind of hopscotch down the country from Wisconsin all the way to Florida, and they have got agreements with private landowners and some state lands between Wisconsin and Florida, and they will stop every night, and these birds will just follow this ultralight plane all the way down to Florida. And it is if you've never seen it before, it is quite the phenomenal sight.
Oh, wonderful. And Jim B. from Cable, Wisconsin. Jim is his last name begins with the letter B, from Cable, is the winner, and he will get a one-year family membership to the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. That's pretty cool. So thanks to our friends at the foundation for providing that prize. And of those who called in, 17 had the correct answers.
That's pretty good.
And if you've never been to the International Crane Foundation, it's worth a trip up there. It's just up there in Baraboo, and they have a representative of every species of crane in the world. And obviously the ICF, or the International Crane Foundation, is a cooperating partner in this experimental population of whooping cranes and Operation Migration. And it is a phenomenal foundation up there that George Archibald and a bunch of others have started and have sustained over a long number of years.
Yeah, long, long time. And I tell you what, it is really a sight. It's really fun to go and visit. I love visiting that place.
Yeah, and a lot of times when you get out of your car, you can hear them before you ever see those cranes. They're pretty loud.
Larry, I want to just put in a quick plug, too, while we're talking about cranes, and there's a lot of interest in this topic. But the Department of Natural Resources on October 31st at noon is going to be hosting a live chat online, and there'll be some experts there. Joan Garland is the outreach coordinator from International Crane Foundation, and Heather Ray is the Associate Director of Development for Operation Migration. And they will be at their computers answering questions that you submit in this online chat. And I've participated and looked through the archives of these chats on various topics that the state does, and they're really pretty fascinating. So if you have an interest in whooping cranes and have some more questions, that's a great place to
excellent
to ask them.
Excellent. So and Wisconsin, we play a pretty big role really in whooping crane conservation, and it takes a lot of partnerships really to make it work. And the main partners, I suppose the DNR is one of them, and obviously the International Crane Foundation.
Yep, International Crane Foundation. I mean, we talked about all those lands that the Operation Migration stops on each night between Wisconsin and Florida. So there's private landowners who are cooperating partners. There's state and county lands, and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service is a big partner. The United States Geological Survey, Patuxent Bird Laboratory out of Maryland, is a big partner. And then, the Crane Foundation is a nonprofit, so there's a lot of people who contribute financial support, and all those people are partners, and, they're unsung heroes. So it is. It's not the magnitude and the logistics to handle something like this. It requires a very diverse partnership.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. David, wildlife specialist with UW Extension. Professor in Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie's Wildlife Outreach Specialist in that department as well. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today as we take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. You may have a question about wildlife. What kinds of wildlife have you been noticing lately, and what are they up to? I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And Liz in Lodi up next with a question. Liz, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure if the sandhill crane was reintroduced in Wisconsin by the International Crane Foundation or if they've always been here, but I noticed them quite frequently in the Lodi area. And they seem to be, like, there's couples, there's always two of them, and they seem to be in specific spots, and I see them over and over again. I look for them every day when I drive my daughter to school. And anyway, I'm wondering if these were raised at the International Crane Foundation or if their children of the ones that were raised there, if they know to fly south.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn to Jamie Knack for that. Hi, Jamie.
Thanks, Liz. So, we can clarify some of that. So the sandhill cranes are not reintroduced. They've been here. They're native, and their populations are doing very, very well. They haven't needed any assistance from the International Crane Foundation. And the behavior that you're seeing now at this time is they're staging, which means they're kind of flocking up from their family units. They're staging in areas, and they will fly south to warmer climates where they can feed. And, you know, in the U.S., Nebraska, even further south than that, but kind of that general area. So, yeah, they're doing quite well in Wisconsin.
And they're very territorial, you know, most of the year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, during the nesting season, for sure. They will definitely protect their nests and that area.
And that's why, Liz, you probably see them in the same place all the time.
Okay, thank you for taking my question.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
And we should say real quick, since we were talking about both whooping cranes and sandhill cranes, that maybe we should identify the differences between those two birds.
But yeah, that's a good idea.
The whooping crane, the adult whooping crane, is all white with a patch of red, or I guess it's red on the top of the head. But when you see them flying, they're unmistakable because they've got this long, outstretched neck, and the legs are trailing behind them, and they're all white birds with black wingtips. Sandhill cranes are more of a grayish bird, or they can be a rusty red bird, depending on their diet. And they've got a red patch to the top of their head. So, and I guess the whooping cranes have a black patch to the top of their head. I think it's black patch. So it is hard to confuse the two of them, especially as adults. But the sandhill cranes, you've got a much, much better chance of seeing a sandhill crane than you do a whooping crane in Wisconsin.
Sue wondered in Mequon how often the cranes need that guidance to get south. I mean, do they?
Every year they do that. Yep. So every single year they train them, and every single year they lead them down to Florida behind an ultralight plane. And this year, I think, if I remember right, I think there were 9 birds that they were leading south. So I only saw 4 yesterday. I'm not sure where the other 5 are, or maybe they're going to make another a second flight behind another ultralight with those other 5.
Okay. Earl in Amro. Hi. Thank you for calling. Earl, are you there? I bet you his phone died on him or something. Earl, you might give us a call back. It's not, looks to me like your phone kind of died. We have other callers online. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Terry in Green Bay, we'll turn to you next. Terry, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, nice to speak with you folks again. I just would like to ask a question. Is that true that the DNR now has opened the deer gun season to rifles statewide?
Hi, Terry. Yes, that is true. The one thing to be cautious about, though, is that municipalities can have their own ordinances. So depending on that DMU, deer management unit, or city that you may be hunting near, you still want to double check any local ordinances or rules pertaining to firearms. But otherwise, statewide, rifles are now usable statewide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really ridiculous move on the DNR's part with all of the subdivisions, and especially we're home being built in the southern part, southwestern part of the state. You know, somebody could have a bullet coming through their window.
Yeah. Well, I'm certain there's been some concern of it, and I'm...
Well, the data hasn't... The reason this rule has been put forward and has moved forward to the, you know, acceptance point, I guess, is that the science has shown, or the data that they have from hunting accidents, is that rifles are no more unsafe than shotguns. And in some cases, in some years, it's shotguns where we see more injury and accidents. But it's based on statistics and really taking this very seriously about expanding that use to include to rifles statewide. But lots of people were involved in looking at that data.
All right, Terry, thanks. Pete in Stoughton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I have a couple of crane stories. First of all, I just talked to DNR a couple of weeks ago. I had a pair of sandhill cranes that were attacking, well, the one was attacking its reflection in my basement window. it peppered the screen. So anyway, I put something in front of there. But they thought it was a little unusual this time of year, but it's perfect height for them to see their reflection. And they are territorial. And then last year when I was deer hunting opening day down near Stoughton, I was in my tree stand and three whooping cranes landed just pretty close to me there. It's pretty neat.
That's one of the joys of being out in the woods is you never know what you're going to see. And so consider yourself lucky seeing the whooping cranes. A lot of people don't have that opportunity. The sand.
Three of them.
Yeah.
Man, are they loud.
Yes, they are. That's one of the reasons they call them whooping cranes is because that loud whooping noise. But all cranes are loud. I don't know if you've ever heard sandhill cranes, they also can make quite the ruckus.
They're like pets out here. It's unbelievable.
Yep.
They're just everywhere.
Yep. Yeah. And sandhill cranes attacking windows is not an uncommon occurrence. And you've done the right thing is trying to break up that reflection as best you can. And we have some friends that live out kind of near where we are, and they've got a pair of sandhill cranes at their wetland that are pretty territorial and pretty aggressive toward them. And so we've had to make some recommendations for our friends to cut down on the opportunity for the sandhill cranes to come so close to the house.
Yeah, they're not too afraid of me, I'll tell you that.
No. Well, you know, some of those,
yeah, slowly walk away.
As tall as some of those sandhills are, you know, they can almost look you in the eye.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it sure scares you when they hit your window with that.
That's right. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate the call.
Be some good video.
You should video that. That would be fun to see. Ruth and Toma, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I'm wondering what's happened to the whippoorwill. As a child, it was a constant in our area, and I haven't heard it for years.
Yeah.
You know, that's a common question amongst people who are familiar with the whippoorwill. And obviously whippoorwills, they sing their name as whippoorwill, whippoorwill. And it's a really distinctive call, and it's a neat call to hear. I'm not sure that there's enough data out there to suggest that the whippoorwill population is in trouble. But the thought is that that if they are in trouble, it's because of habitat loss or habitat destruction. And you'll find pockets of whippoorwills throughout the state sometimes where they seem to be pretty healthy in population. In other places, you'll talk to people like yourself, Ruth, and they'll say, you know, I remember them being here, and I don't hear them as often as I do anymore. So it would be a shame if we lose them because they're such a distinctive bird and it's just such a neat sound to hear.
Yeah. I'm with you, Ruth. I haven't heard them either. I used to hear them, you know, as a kid. You heard them all the time, and now I never hear them.
Well, yes, I lived near some marshland, and it was loud at night.
And
haven't heard them for probably, I would say, 15 to 20 years in Toma.
Yep, a couple years ago, not only did a pair of southern flying squirrels, but also whippoorwills got me through a very long Shakespeare play out at the American Players Theater. And it was a wonderful thing to listen to for a couple hours. The whippoorwills, that is.
Oh, there you go. Thanks, Ruth. Appreciate the call. We have more callers online. Let's go to Darren in Madison. Darren, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. And I had a question about seemingly strange behavior of owls and green herons, particularly an owl experience the other week. It was in the Milwaukee area. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was sitting at the top of a driveway in a suburban subdivision, and a big owl. I don't know. It was not a great horn, but it was sizable. It might have just been a large barred. But it came up and it flew right in front of me, and it kind of plopped down right in the grass, just about 9 feet in front of my face. And it turned and it looked at me and kind of inspected me and kind of wiggled its wings a bit. And it stood there, and I was talking on the phone for about maybe 20, 30 seconds. And then it flew off across the street. And, you know, it's easy for people to attach meaning to a lot of things. And earlier that evening, my grandfather had passed away. So it was easy to kind of, you know, humanize the experience. And I was just curious, how typical is that? I've seen owls and I've had owl encounters, but never where they plopped down in front of me and stared at me for about 20, 30 seconds. Any thoughts on that?
Very interesting.
Yeah, Darren, that's a neat story. And sorry to hear about your grandfather. You know, owls are just a neat animal. Every species of wildlife is neat, I think. But you know, I've had that before. I've been in the woods before birding, and I've had an owl come, you know, swoop over my head and land not in the grass in front of me, but they've landed on a nearby branch and just kind of looked at me. And I think, you know, a lot of these animals are curious, and when they see something that is, a little unfamiliar in their territory, they want to inspect it and see what's going on and see if there's any threat to it. And I'm guessing that's probably what was going on with you, is the owl is just curious to see, you know, who is this person and why is there this strange glow coming off their face from their cell phone, and are they going to threaten me?
Yeah.
Darren, sure, just another observation, but it's not uncommon to see barred or great horned owls dead on the side of the road as well. And I think that they either, I'm not sure what the cause and effect is, but they are either blinded by the headlights, or the headlights are able to, you know, illuminate the road ditch or something along those lines, but they become car fatalities as well. So,
yeah, because the owls will. Oh, go on, Darren.
Oh, I was just going to tack onto that. I guide kayak trips for my business and do birding tours, and we've seen a lot of green herons, which had in years past, typically I had chalked them up to a relatively reclusive bird that avoided human contact. But especially in the Madison area, Cherokee Marsh, even Winger Creek, these green herons are just everywhere, sometimes almost like sparrows. And I was wondering if that's a change in typical green heron behavior, or if that if they've always been like that, you know.
They haven't always been like that, I don't think. I'm here again, I'm with you a little bit. I've seen a lot of green herons in the Madison area.
Yeah. We could do some digging on the atlas and see if surveys are being done for those as well. But a lot of it can just be, you know, you're in the right place and some really quality habitat that the birds have keyed in recent years. So habitat is always changing and evolving and succeeding into different stages. So it just might be that is getting to be a really optimal stage of habitat where you're leading those trips, and the herons are raising families and doing quite well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Darren. Appreciate the call. And Jeff in Warrens, Wisconsin. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've recently moved up here from southern part of the state, but in my drivings around here, I've been noticing the bean fields that have been picked. There are literally hundreds of sand hills in the bean fields up here by the cranberry bogs that are full of sand hills. They're staging up here, and you know, I didn't notice them first, but you could hear them at night and in the mornings when they're, you know, sounding off. But just to see all these great bodies out there walking around on these spindly little legs or their little red heads, and it's just kind of neat, you know. At one time, you know, they were not that many of them to the point, you know, that there are as many of them as now, but there was just, the fields are just full of them. You know, they're pushing out a little bit now that it's getting cold, but there was just literally hundreds of them out here for the longest time.
That's a cool sight, isn't it?
It is. They look so prehistoric because they are so huge. And we have the same thing. There's a number of fields that we keep an eye on in Columbia County. And I take the kids over and, you know, pull over on the side of the road and just watch them and roll down the windows and listen. And it is quite a sight. It's a fun time of year to watch wildlife as they're getting ready for winter.
You know, you always hear these stories, especially from your grandparents and people, you know, back in the day, of these large, massive migrations where they just see with thousands and thousands of animals moving, primarily birds, but sometimes you hear this with elk and things like that. But I've never had the experience of that, other than we were in Homer, Alaska, at the tip of the Kenai Peninsula, southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula, and my wife and I, we must have counted, we estimated over 10,000 sandhill cranes migrating, and we just stood there probably in about a 45-minute period, and I have never seen that mass of wildlife in my life, and it is quite the impressive sight.
That is really, really cool. Jeff, thank you.
No, you're welcome. That was kind of neat. I've never seen a, you know, you always hear them, you know, here a pair or there, but just that, you know, massive amount, that was kind of cool.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks again for calling. We had a caller wonder if the wolf hunt, but just back to that for a minute, is helping or hurting the diversity of the genetic pool. You know, it's kind of early in the day to be.
It is a little early to be speculating on some of that, but it's certainly a logical question to be asking, and certainly something the state will be monitoring. But when you think about a wolf, it's a pack animal, and typically it's the alpha male and the alpha female, the dominant members of that particular pack, that do the breeding. So we can kind of speculate further, and if that pack male or the pack female was harvested, it would certainly change the pack dynamic, and you'd have a subadult male or female replacing that wolf, introducing new genetics and so on. But overall, I would suspect that it certainly wouldn't hurt the genetics of the wolf population by having that harvest, because we're talking about a fairly large number of animals in the population.
Well, we've got coming up, I know from Facebook, Jerry wants to know a little bit about, has some comments about Operation Migration with the Hoopers, and Jim and Madison is wondering about a huge grayish-blue bird in California, and we've got questions about bluebirds, the bluebirds' houses in fall, and a whole lot more. And so I hope you'll stay with us. David Drake and Jamie Knack will be with us right up until 12:30, but let's take a quick look at the news. Next. Many of us who live in Wisconsin count our amazing wildlife as one of our treasures, and whether you're new to wildlife watching or been doing it all your life, it's great to have people who know and care about our environment to talk with about our wildlife. Larry Mueller here. Jamie Knack is the Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again.
And David Drake, Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension, Associate Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW. David, thank you again as well.
Well, thank you, Larry.
We have some callers online, but we have an open line or two for you. Maybe you've got a question about migration, about the birds that are out there, or animals that you've seen or maybe would like to see. Call us at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can post right there. Jim in Madison has a question. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. Good morning, folks. I was working detailing boats in Long Beach, California for a time. And one morning, early morning, a little after dawn, I saw this majestic bird come up on the pier. And it walked slowly toward me, very kind of spooky almost. It was tall. Now, my imagination might be a little extended, but it seemed to me it was about 5 feet tall, and it was like a grayish-blue color. I wonder, was that a crane or a heron, or what was I looking at?
Jim, as you think back on that, do you recall it was the neck kind of bent in a bit of a S shape?
No, it was walking right toward me. I just saw the...
Okay.
I didn't see a profile, really.
Yeah, I'm guessing from the description of what you're talking about, I'm guessing it's a great blue heron. And you may want to look that up either in a bird book, or if you have an internet, just go to a search engine that has an image search engine and type in great blue heron and see if that's what you saw. But great blue herons can stand about 4 feet tall, so you're not too far off with the 5 foot mark. And they are very, very majestic birds, and they're very quiet. They hunt by surprise, and that's how they catch their food. And just they're really neat birds, and they're rather common birds, especially around water.
Yeah.
Very, very quiet and very majestic. So you say about 4 feet tall. What's the tallest bird? Is it a crane then? Or?
Yeah, it's the whooping crane. Yep.
How tall will that go?
I want to say, I don't know, five and a half feet, something like that.
Huh. And the difference between the diets of the one you described as brown or orange and the white one, what is the difference in the diet that causes a different coloration in skin?
So for the sandhill and the whooping cranes, both of them, when they're up here, eat primarily invertebrates, so insects and things like that, but they'll also eat, frogs and things out of the wetlands and stuff like that. But I believe, if I recall this correctly, the sandhill cranes, the coloration, or that rusty coloration, is from the diet and the soil the diet's coming from. So there's minerals in the soil that are changing that coloration. Oh, and that can be somewhat common with, you know, other birds. Flamingos, for example, they get that pink because of the shrimp that they eat. And so their diet can sometimes affect the coloration.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling, Jim. John in Green Bay, hi, your turn now. Thanks for calling.
Well, the reason I'm calling, in the late 60s, I lived on a small farm just outside of Burlington. And I came home one afternoon about 6 o'clock, and alongside County J, there was an endless tube of blackbirds. It was just like they were inside of a tube, just mm-hmm. below the telephone poles alongside the road, and there were millions of them just going south in this endless tube. And I went in and got my wife, brought her back out. We stood there for a half hour, 45 minutes, just watching them. Now, I don't recall if they were, you know, if they were all starlings or if they were a mix of other blackbirds, but it was unreal.
No.
About 6 feet, 6 feet by 6 feet, just one, and they were going wide open. And they were probably 10 feet above the ground.
Wow.
You're talking about migrations. That was my experience, and that was in the late 60s, probably 69 or 70.
Wow.
Well, thanks for sharing that, John. And that is something that can still be observed. I mean, on an annual regular basis in the fall, blackbirds will flock up and kind of travel in those waves, and it's a real undulated flight, but as a group. So it's almost like a cloud of insects, but it's these birds all kind of moving like a school of fish would move and counteracting each other and not colliding. And it's just really beautiful to watch.
Beautiful to watch. And it's a protective device, I suppose,
for
them.
Yeah.
You know, with that many for a bird of prey or whatever to sort
safety
of
in numbers.
Zero in on one. It's, yeah. Thanks a lot, John. Cass in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
I'm actually following up with what another caller was talking about with the whippoorwill decline. We were actually speaking of this last night, and my father blames it pretty much exclusively on the feral cats that are in the area, you know, out in Richland County and other parts of southern Wisconsin. I was just wondering if anyone had a comment on with the feral cats, how that's changing, and if they're affecting.
Yeah, we're losing you there, Cass, but I think we've got your question.
Yeah, so feral cats certainly have been documented to, you know, be detrimental to bird populations, mammal populations, reptile amphibian populations, things like that. I don't know, and I've not heard or I've not seen anything in the literature that feral cats have been documented as causing the decline in whippoorwills, if there is, in fact, a decline in whippoorwills. And most of what I've seen in the literature is due to habitat loss or habitat degradation. So certainly feral cats, they are destructive. They can be destructive to wildlife populations. And I would guess that over history that the feral cats have gotten a whippoorwill or two, but I don't know that they've been they have not been instrumental in the decline of whippoorwills, if that in fact is true.
One of many things that could be contributing factors, I guess.
It could be, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep, there you go. Thanks, Cass. Polly in Round Lake Beach, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. This is because you were talking about sandhill cranes.
Yeah.
And I haven't been up here just a few years. I used to live in Indiana. In an hour south of Chicago, in the Jasper-Pulaski wildlife area, there is a staging area there that's all marked out and saved for them on what used to be a marsh.
Yeah.
And you can see it when you're just driving by there at evenings and early morning. It looks like, they say, prehistoric. They get 10 to 12,000 cranes there during the peak. And it's quite something. Yeah. And I was lucky enough, my whole family got to see 5 whooping cranes there at the same time. They had stopped in.
Oh.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, but
you know, those
numbers are just
Unbelievable.
There are a number of places in the country where you have these large concentrations of sandhill cranes, and one of them is Indiana, another one is down in Nebraska.
Right, that's a lot farther away.
It is, yep, it is. But, you know, and again, we've talked about this already today, but just the noisiness of these birds. But when you have such a large concentration, I mean, you can literally hear them from a great distance away because they are so loud. And I used to trap prairie chickens down on the coast of, Gulf Coast of Texas, and we'd be in the blinds getting ready to trap prairie chickens. And, you
this
know,
is for research,
this for research purposes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it was really for research purposes, but you know, it'd be dark and you'd see this fog, but you would hear these sandhill cranes calling over the, out of the fog. And it is quite an eerie sound at that point, but it is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Thanks, Molly.
Yeah. And the other, also last weekend over were pelicans. They were migrating and they were coming down.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And we have a lot more pelicans now.
There's eight of them, but...
Yeah, we do. The white pelican is the species we have up here in Wisconsin, and they come up here for the summer. But if you go up, you know, areas of Green Bay and Lake Michigan and parts of Lake Superior, and, you know, even some of the inland lakes in Wisconsin, Minnesota, you'll see large, large flocks of white pelicans. And I'm guessing that if they're not already a problem species, they will be a problem species here in the next decade or so, because they are... increasing in numbers in a pretty good fashion.
Yeah.
I thought it was a real nice surprise. I didn't know they were.
Thank you very much for calling. It was a nice surprise. Heather and Bloomer, your turn. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been absolutely intrigued by my beautiful, huge, great toads that were out by my dog kennels at night. I picked them up and rubbed their bellies and put them down, and they became wonderful friends.
Oh, that's great.
Did you name them?
And this year I've seen one, and I miss them, and I wonder what's happened. I also have a small in-ground fish pond with lights, and they would sit out there catching whatever they're catching. And I just can't understand what's happened to them.
Yeah, well, good question, David.
That's a good question. You know, toads are pretty common species, and so we've got 11 frog species and one toad species in Wisconsin here. And toads of the frog species, they've got the thicker skin, so that's what allows them to move a greater distance away from water than most frogs can. And so a lot of times you'll find, as long as you've got moist soil, you may not necessarily have a standing body of water nearby, but as long as you have moist soil, you'll find toads. And again, it could just be that toads are, you know, they are a mobile species, and I don't know, maybe they don't like you rubbing their belly. And they said, hey, don't go to Heather's house. So, but they, you know, they're just like most wild species, the populations can fluctuate locally and regionally. And so, you know, maybe next year the toads will be back because they're different toads and they like their bellies being rubbed. Who knows?
All right. Thanks, Heather. Thanks for calling. And Tom in Charleston, South Carolina. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I heard a rumor that hunters that are using dogs, training dogs to hunt bear and stuff like that, that if an animal dies, a dog dies, that the DNR is replaced or reimbursing the hunter for the cost of the dog. Is that correct?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the call. And actually, this is a fairly controversial subject, as you might imagine, with wolves being involved and bears being involved and the human side of people's dogs being part of the equation as well. And it is true with wolves, if you are bear hunting with hounds and a wolf kills your bear hound, you can be reimbursed. The money for that, now that the wolves are delisted and in the Bureau of Wildlife Management, that money comes from the license revenue from the wolf licenses and the permit application as of the last 2 years. So that's where that money is coming from. It's not coming out of the Bureau of Endangered Resources anymore to pay for those claims. And part of this, you know, there's a lot of factors that came into that evolved in having this program available. And part of it is the wolf population is above the goal of 350, as stated in the management plan, the recovery plan for wolves, well above that goal. And there are other users of the public lands and private lands out there. And, you know, the wolves are taking some of those dogs, again, territorial animals, protecting their territories and so on. So there's also been quite a bit of effort from the Department of Natural Resources to educate hunters and make very readily available any of the pack information. So if you went to the Department of Natural Resources website and looked at the map of the pack distributions that they're aware of, there's little polygons that kind of outline where that pack territory is. So a hunter with a hound could be looking at that information prior to getting into a specific area of the state. And also they track when hounds are killed, and we had a very high mortality of bear hounds this year, over 20. They will put out little notices and alerts that a hound was killed. Here's the situations, here's the location, and they build kind of a border around that area and let hunters know that they should avoid those areas because there's a fairly territorial and active pack in that area. So that's the state of the state on that subject.
Certainly a very controversial issue, for sure. Edie and Baraboo, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Yesterday morning at my bird feeder, right outside the window here, I had, I think, a white-faced or white, creamy-colored goldfinch. But it was definitely white. And it looked like it was all puffed up because it was cold, but it looked a little bigger than a goldfinch. It had dark wings, kind of cream-colored. It really wasn't white.
The wings weren't.
Yeah, the whole body, but the wings were dark. Would that be something else?
Some sort of like piebald type?
It could be a piebald, which is albino form, although it's not a true albino because it didn't have the pink eyes. Or if it's a mammal, it wouldn't have a pink nose. But it could be possibly a piebald goldfinch. You know, goldfinches, obviously, in the wintertime, they will change from that very, very, especially the males, change from that very, very bright gold, and they'll become more of a buffy green. And it could be just that particular individual has changed into more of a much lighter color of the winter coat, possibly.
Really whitish.
You know, we do have snow buntings in the state of Wisconsin here, and I don't know that it would be a snow bunting, but you might want to look up snow bunting in your bird book or online, again, if you've got a web search engine that has the image capability. But is snow bunting, two words, B-U-N-T-I-N-G, and see if that's what you saw.
Yeah.
Would they be at the feeder eating sunflower seeds?
They could be.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Possibly.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Edie.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call. And speaking of feeders, I got a great email from Todd. How do birds know when feeders are filled? I can have all my feeders empty and no birds around at all. As soon as I fill them, they are there within minutes. And I've had that same experience. Probably all of us
have. Are you ringing the dinner bell?
Yeah. Can they smell the seed and soon? Yeah. Or are they just, you know, watching? It happens, you know, every time you're around. Yeah. And he's exactly right.
Yep. And I'll say, Todd, you've got smell the seed in parentheses. And so with rare exceptions, birds have a very, very poor sense of smell. You know, they don't have a developed olfactory gland in their nares or their nose. So they don't smell. But what happens, I mean, it really is a little bit like ringing a dinner bell. And I know when, you know, I was a kid, we did have a triangle out the back door. And when it was time to come home for dinner, my mom rang that bell and we heard it and we came running. And birds have, you know, a defined home range, and within that defined home range, they've got a pretty good sense of where the food resources are and things like that. And they are, you know, when they're active and awake, they're scanning for, within that home range, they're scanning for food and danger and things like that. And so it doesn't take them too long to be aware that, hey, the feeder is now full. It's time to come to the dinner table and let's take advantage of it while it's there.
Gary in Boscobel, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call, Larry. I'd like to have a minute to challenge your guest's statements that the ruffed grouse and the whippoorwills have declined in numbers because of habitat change. And I'd like to state the case that I believe after a number of years, I live here in the Southwest region, and after a number of years of pondering these questions and actually going out and doing some on-the-ground investigation,
and listening to other wildlife researchers pose their theories that it's habitat change. I don't believe it is habitat change. I think that there are a number of issues that have happened here, and one of them is that the populations of coon, skunks, and possums have increased. And I've seen research that has photographed, documented white-tailed deer eating bird chicks out of grassland nests where cameras were put on these nests to monitor predation. So it's a proven fact that deer will indeed eat chicks.
As well. And because we're short of time, I want to give our guests a chance to comment.
Sure. Thanks, Gary. And I think you are certainly correct here. So I think there's interactions going on. And I think, you know, most wildlife professionals would agree completely with you that it's a combination of things like habitat and predators. And in some situations of specific species, there may be additional players that are all coming together that are causing these declines. And I can speak a little bit on the grassland birds. They've declined over significantly over the last 30 years. It's actually the group of birds that I did my master's work on here at Stevens Point. And I, in fact, was one of those persons that put cameras on those little ground nesting birds. And I'm familiar with the deer research that you're talking about that came out of North Dakota with Pamela Peets. And she was a collaborator on some of the work that I did here in Wisconsin. And for the Wisconsin birds that I was monitoring, savanna sparrows, bobolinks, grasshopper sparrows, meadowlarks, species like that, the number one predator, and I worked in pasture systems, so continuously grazed pastures, was raccoons. Far and wide, raccoons were the most common. But yeah, it did include other species, snakes and badgers, and we had cattle in there. Cattle actually caused nests to fail as well. So I agree with you that predators and the increase of some of these predators that have adapted very well to fragmentation, it's that combination. Because of the fragmented landscape, a lot of these animals like raccoon, skunk, and possum that are adaptable and generalists and have responded well to even humans encroaching, they certainly are players in this whole system.
Good call. Thank you very much for calling. And Tom and Madison, just on another topic here quickly before we're out of time. Tom wonders what might be a peak time to view migrating waterfowl or essentially geese at Horicon Marsh.
Go now. Don't wait. Go this weekend. Seriously, there's a friends group at Horicon Marsh and also both state and federal sides of the marsh. And they all have websites. They're probably posting somewhere what the current numbers are. But typically, it's the middle of October to the very beginning of November. And with all the cold weather we've had, I wouldn't be surprised if it's really, really good right now. I went maybe 3 weeks ago with the family, and there were certainly birds there, but not as many as I would expect there to be right now. And for Canada geese, you're talking 200,000 birds. So, do put that on your list of things to do soon.
Yeah, and it's great. Actually, this time of year, it's great. You got a nice day to walk.
There's some great paths
out there, and you're going to see lots of birds. David, Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You'll be back again. We'll do this again, I hope.
Yep, I think we're coming back in December. So we'll see you then.
Perfect. David Drake, Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW. Jamie Knack in that same department. She's a Wildlife Outreach Specialist there. Thanks to them. Thank you for listening in. October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. We'll find out how to stay safe online and get some information for senior citizens and their caregivers for trick-or-treaters. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.